Hello, hey. Everyone. Welcome to the second season of Paleo Party. My name is Thomas. I'm joined with Dr. Dunn and Dr. Dean. Hi. And welcome to the second season of an interactive podcast. It's our pleasure to have you all with us tonight. And before I start, I have to make a very special announcement, and that is that this season is sponsored by a very generous outreach grant from the Paleontological Society, so thank you very much to them. But without further ado, it's my pleasure to introduce our special guest for this evening, a paleogeneticist, author, and proud Scot. It's Dr. Ross Barnett, everyone! Woo!
Hello! Lovely to be here.
We ask all of our guests to attempt to explain what they do using the OpGore 5 text editor, which only allows you to use the 1,000 most commonly used words in the English language to explain any complex idea. This is especially tricky, seeing as neither paleontology nor fossil appear amongst these 1,000 most common words. So Ross, we can't wait to hear what you've come up with.
All right. So yeah, this is great. The OpGore 5 is really useful tool, I think. And thank God it has old as one of the top 1,000 words, is all I'm going to say. So I tried to kind of put in like a mini bio about what I've done. And so this is what I came up with. So I am a person who looks at old things, especially old things that are no longer here anymore. I look at the tiny bits of life inside cells that have died to see if they can tell us about relationships. Cats are the animals whose relationships I look at the most. Cats with big teeth are the best. I also wrote a book about dead animals. I like to find old things on the ground and take them home. So that's basically it in a nutshell, I would say. So I tried to kind of, I mean, yeah, it's tricky, really tricky.
It worked really well.
Yeah, you did an excellent job.
I'm amazed that cells is in there.
Yeah.
Yeah. Nice. Weird.
Double check, but yeah, it didn't come up with red for them, so.
Excellent. Well, yeah, we are an interactive podcast, as you are all aware. So throughout the evening, please feel free to send in your questions into the chat here, or you can do it on Twitter to our handle at PaleoParty. Send in your questions for Ross about pretty much anything. Whatever you want to ask, go ahead. We are here to answer your beck and call. Leading on kind of from that, obviously you've done an expert job in describing your research using the OpGore 5, but do you want to elaborate on it at all? Is there anything?
No.
Yeah, word. Stream Respect over. That. Thanks very much, guys. See you all next week.
So I mean, my kind of background is ancient DNA. So it's looking at, I mean, it's a very broad church, I think, ancient DNA, but it's looking at the genetics of things that haven't been stored in a kind of regulated way. So trying to get stuff to work that shouldn't normally work. So anything from, you know, museum taxidermy to subfossils to, you know, spirit stored specimens to bits of fur, bits of skin, all this kind of stuff. Trying to get what is usually quite degraded DNA out of these battered old bits of cells. And then using kind of pretty powerful molecular biology techniques like PCR to amplify them up and then read them, so sequence the DNA. And then from that, we can do all sorts of things, mostly looking at kind of relationships between different species. So whether, you know, one species that's extinct is a close relative of one that's alive, or looking at kind of variation. So looking at kind of how different extinct subspecies relate to living subspecies. There's a lot. It's all kind of very Jerry Springer. It's all a bit about, you know, what does the DNA test say? You are the father, kind of stuff. But in a lot of really, really kind of quite varied contexts. I mean, I've worked mostly on cats, but I've also kind of branched out into pigs, chickens, bears, river dolphins, lynx, cheetahs. Well, those are cats, aren't they? Yeah, I haven't done any human stuff because that's really difficult and has a whole bunch of other problems. But any kind of animal stuff, I've been willing to give a go at.
You've even wrote a book about it.
Yeah. So the book kind of came about because, I mean, I'm not really in academia anymore. I haven't done any kind of lab work for a couple of years now. And that's for a number of reasons, but, you know, basically academia is really hard to stay in, and the attrition rate's pretty huge, and I'm part of that statistic now, I think. But yeah, looking for something to do while looking after kids, and kind of scribbling away in between school drop-off and school pickup was one of the things that I thought I could do. And so kind of starting in late 2017, I wrote a book called The Missing Links, which basically kind of I tried to distill everything that I'd found interesting from working in ancient DNA and looking at the Ice Age and extinction and put it into a book form and get it out there.
I don't see enough hype about the title of that
book. Yeah, I knew. I was going to make a whole pun at the beginning about how you were the missing links, but then I just thought maybe that would be a bit rude.
So, no, I would have loved that.
So let's
next time.
Let's backtrack for a minute, and so there's two things I'd like to explore before we go too far. Firstly, I want to say hi to everyone in the chat. There's lots of people in the chat saying hello, which is very nice. So hi, everyone. Don't forget that you can ask Ross questions in real time. I'll throw your questions to him. I can see some coming in already, so we'll get to those in a second. But I want to just take a few steps back. So I'd like, if we could, just a little bit of an explanation about DNA and why DNA is useful and what kind of things you were doing with DNA, if you don't mind. And then I suppose after that, we could move into how you got into working in DNA.
Sure. Okay. So DNA is basically the kind of instruction book for life. So in each of your cells, you've got lots of DNA. You get 50% from your mom, 50% from your dad, and they kind of mix together and tell your cells how to be cells and how to multiply, how to kind of join together, how to form tissues. And it's basically like a digital code. I mean, it's not all that different from, you know, binary, except it's a base 4 code. You know, it's like its own little language, essentially, except with only 4 letters. And those 4 letters are 4 different chemical bases. And DNA, if anyone knows anything about DNA, they know it's a double helix, which is this really beautiful kind of swirly pattern. And it's made up of 2 strands, and those 2 strands are exactly complementary. So if you've got one thing on one strand, you've got something else on the other strand, you only ever find 2 that would join together that are complementary. So if you've got an A on one strand, you've got a T on the other strand. If you've got a T on one strand, you've got an A on the other strand. And I mean, this is the kind of very kind of brass tacks. This is the kind of beauty of life. This is what Watson and Crick, when they discovered the structure of DNA, were so hyped about, is that with those 2 strands, if you separate them in half, you can reconstruct the other half from each strand. So, I mean, that's essentially how life happens. It goes from a double helix to 2 single helixes, and then those 2 single helices can build themselves back up again. And that's, you know, that's life, essentially. So it's pretty neat. I think they did a good job when they made that. And I've forgotten what the rest of your question was.
The next part of the question was, what did you do with DNA? Like, specifically, what were you looking for?
Okay. Yeah, so, I mean, DNA, apart from, you know, being the stuff of life, is really useful for working out relationships between species. So each, the closer together species are, evolutionarily speaking, the more in common their DNA will have. So, for instance, most people know that, you know, humans and chimps and bonobos share like 99% of their DNA. That means that if you compare the DNA from a chimp and the DNA from a human, and you look at it together, you'll find that at 99% of the places where they're beside each other, the letter of DNA will be the same, and only a few of them will be different. And because of the way that evolution works, the more distant you are in the kind of tree of life, the more different your DNA is, which is really useful as a way of working out relationships. So, you know, chimps and humans are 99% identical. Humans and gorillas are maybe 98%. Humans and gibbons, 95%. And so on down to, you know, humans and bananas are still 50% identical. Because when you think about it, most of the DNA does stuff that works inside the cell at a kind of molecular level. And that's, you know, the basic architecture is all the same all the way through, you know, the entire eukaryotic kingdom. So, yeah, the farther back you go, the more different it is, but it never gets that different. which is quite useful because when you're comparing, you know, I don't know, saber-tooth cats and lions to cheetahs and lynxes, then you're still talking like, you know, 80, 90, 95% similarity. And we can use computer models to kind of model that evolutionary history and work out some of the things I've been involved with, looking at like saber-tooths like Smilodon and Homotherium, working out that they're actually, you know, they've separated from the modern cats that we have around today, like lions and tigers and house cats, by about 20 million years. And we can work that out just from the DNA and just using computer modeling of the differences we find in the DNA sequences.
So this is something I'm kind of fascinated in. I come from a geology background. I'm a rock hound. and the mere concept of DNA in the kind of paleontological record is like the stuff of dreams. Like, all my stuff is so old, there's just no hope of it. And so this realm of like ancient DNA is entirely new to me, and I'm kind of a bit mind blown by it, to put it mildly. So I'm just kind of fascinated, like, how do you get that preserved, and kind of what state is it in? Like, what do you have to do, like, physically, what do you have to do to be able to figure this out? Because, you know, obviously more recent material is going to be, you know, hopefully slightly better preserved, but, you know, this stuff has still been potentially underground for like tens of thousands of years. How it's just mind-blowing to me.
I always remember my friend Mike Bunce, who taught me a lot in the lab when I was a PhD student, saying that it's bucket chemistry. It's not, there's nothing really kind of that fancy, chemically speaking, that's being done. So, I mean, DNA itself isn't very stable. I mean, it's quite an unstable molecule. You have to remember it's in, you know, stretches of, you know, millions of base pairs long, just a really long, thin, almost, you know, one-dimensional strand. And it breaks really easily. So, I mean, this is one of the main problems with ancient DNA work, is that it's fragmented. And so it's like, you know, a big jigsaw puzzle you have to try and put back together. But if we're talking about just the chemistry of how you go from a little bit of bone to a DNA sequence, then, you know, it's not that hard, really. I mean, you can get, you know, undergrads or master's students to do it. So that tells you how straightforward it is. I mean, it's not complex. You just take the bone, you grind it up, just to increase the surface area. You then throw a whole bunch of reagents at it. So stuff like EDTA, which is a chemical that binds to the calcium in the bone and kind of takes it out of solution, stops it messing up with other stuff. You add enzymes that break down the protein. You add detergents that bind to the fat part, which is in the cell membranes and in the bone as well. And basically, all you're doing is kind of getting rid of everything that isn't DNA. So breaking up everything that isn't DNA. And then, because DNA is quite a large molecule, as I said, it's, you know, millions of base pairs long. Obviously, in ancient stuff, it's usually only maybe, if you're lucky, 300 or 400 base pairs long. You take this stuff, you put it through a filter, and everything that isn't DNA should kind of just get sucked straight through. And then you do, you know, a couple of other things to get the DNA out. And then you've got like a test tube, a little mini plastic test tube, with DNA somewhere in it. You can't see it, though. I do often, like, I do remember taking a look and saying, yeah, there's definitely stuff in there. And then the key part, the complicated part, and the only part where there's actually kind of quite complex chemistry, is how you go from that tube of DNA to enough DNA that you can do downstream sequencing reactions. So for this, you need not just a few copies of a couple of hundred base pairs, you need, you know, millions of copies of those hundreds of base pairs. And so you use a really kind of important reaction technique called PCR, polymerase chain reaction. And, you know, all this does is essentially takes what happens in your cells every time they divide. So when your cell and the DNA that's in it divides, there's enzymes that come along, split the double helix into two, and add new bases to each single strand to make up the complementary strand. So you end up with two double helices. So PCR essentially uses enzymes and the basic components of DNA and does that in the test tube. And I mean, it's a really kind of clever technique. The guy that invented it, Carey Mullis, he got the Nobel Prize for it. And it's used pretty much any molecular biology lab anywhere in the world.
It's used for COVID tests, and this is in the news.
Yeah, exactly, the expensive one.
Yeah. This is This is like the best thing about paleontology as well. It's like we pick the best things from other sciences and just throw them together and look at ancient life with them. I think I love that about paleontology.
Yeah, and that's the way to do it. I mean, let all the other schmoes like do the hard work and just take the good stuff that they that they've invented. But yeah, so that's it. And so hopefully, if you kind of think of PCR as a black box, it's like a big kind of photocopier for DNA. And you know, there's lots of problems with it that kind of beset, particularly ancient DNA work. But if it works successfully, you get millions of copies of the bit of DNA that you're interested in, which is hopefully from the original owner of the bone that you've just ground up. And then you can take that and do other quite complicated chemistry, but you know, not that hard really. And it's also a modified form of PCR, and that reads the sequence for you. And then you end up with essentially like a Word doc, which just has those four letters, A, C, G, and T, repeated all the way through them. And that's your DNA sequence at the end. And that's, you can use that, you stick it in, there's various kind of software programs that you can use to compare them amongst species or amongst individuals and to work out relationships.
That's amazing.
That sounds super cool. But when you talk like this, you don't sound like a paleontologist. Where did you come from? How did you get into this?
Well, yeah. So, I mean, my undergraduate was in biochemistry. So I did that in Edinburgh. And that's mainly because, you know, at school, I really loved biology and I really loved chemistry. And I didn't do physics. So I thought that was the kind of the best sort of science course for me would be biochemistry. So I did that in Edinburgh. It was great. And then towards the end of that, I was looking for what to do next. I was about to graduate. I didn't have a job lined up. I kind of was looking for what to do. And this was early 2000s. And just about towards the end of my third year of undergraduate, I read about this paper in Nature where the first paper ever to sequence the complete genome of an extinct species. So this is... they looked at moa, which are these giant kind of ostrich-like birds from New Zealand, and they'd got the complete mitochondrial DNA, which is a really small chunk that sits inside cells and does its own thing, and which you get only from your maternal lineage. So we all have the same mitochondrial DNA as our mothers do, and they have the same as their mothers, et cetera, et cetera. And so they'd managed to sequence the complete mitochondrial genome of a moa, which is the first time this had ever been done for an extinct species. And I got a lot of press, and I discovered that the work had been done in Oxford. And so as I was coming up to the end of my undergraduate, I kind of directly emailed the group that had been involved with that work and asked them if they had any PhD places open. And then they didn't like welcome me with open arms. There wasn't like somewhere straight away. So I applied to a whole bunch of different PhD programs, but sort of said, you know, this is my first choice. If you guys can find something for me to do here, then this is where I'd want to be. And at the kind of last minute they did. And so I turned up. That was great. And in the first couple of weeks, I think my choices were I could either do horses or I could do cats. And I thought, well, it's not really, it's not
no
really
contest.
Much choice there.
No
yeah.
contest.
So I went for cats, and that's how it started.
You were literally at the beginning of all of this massive hype.
Yeah, like, that's one thing that's like mind-blowing for me is, so as you know, as someone who's researching at the moment, like paleo DNA and stuff is so, it's almost like it's completely blasé now. Like we just accept it's a thing. You know, I regularly work on pigments and like, you know, paleo proteins and stuff like that that are sort of hundreds of millions of years old. But yet, when you were like getting started, this is like cutting edge, like the most sci-fi
really
thing, right?
Yeah, and I think that's probably why it kind of appealed to me, that whole kind of sci-fi. I mean, I was a massive Jurassic Park fan when it came out.
I need the horn. I should.
Surely a klaxon should go off somewhere, like QI style.
Yeah.
Yeah. But yeah, I mean that's kind of what drew me to that, and it did get a lot of press at the time, mostly because of the kind of Jurassic Park angle. But the sort of late 90s, there was very much, it was kind of a, you know, the dark ages of ancient DNA work, because they'd realized that a lot of the earlier work, the stuff that Jurassic Park had been based on, you know, this idea of getting dinosaur DNA or stuff that was, you know, tens of millions or hundreds of millions of years old, that was all wrong. It had been published, but it was not replicable. And so like the late 90s was like the kind of worst aspect of ancient DNA work. And then just when I was kind of coming out of undergraduate, it was starting to build itself back up again. Mm. And so I was really lucky that they took me on and that I was there kind of at the second coming of ancient DNA, essentially. It's pure luck. I mean, pure luck.
That's
so cool.
So in the chat, there are some unbelievable questions coming in. So put your seatbelt on.
Right.
BWIT47 asks, how do you go about designing PCR primers for extinct species when working with ancient DNA? And that is a question that I have never even thought of.
That's a really great question, though. That's obviously someone that knows their PCR. So, it comes back to this whole idea of, you know, when you do alignments of DNA from different species. So let's say I wanted to work on designing primers for Smilodon, a saber-toothed cat. We know from the paleontologists who've told us that the bones are sort of cat-like, but definitely in the kind of cat side of the carnivore family tree. So what we can do then for designing primers, if you design an alignment which has hyenas, has badger, it has some of the cats, a whole bunch of representative carnivores that are on the same kind of area as we think that the saber-toothed cats would be, we can then design the primers to kind of match all of them because of the degree of kind of conservatism in the DNA sequences. There's always going to be regions where, you know, it codes for the start of the gene, or it codes for, you know, something that is so essential that it just can't change without damaging the organism. And so when I was working on, you know, mitochondrial DNA from extinct lines, it was super easy because we knew that they were kind of lion-like, so we could design them based on lions and other kind of close relatives like tigers and jaguars and leopards and things like that. So it's basically using the whole idea of these are going to be kind of similar, hopefully different. We'll find parts of the DNA sequence where there's a lot of similarity between a whole kind of range of species, and then use that to design the primers. But that's a really perceptive question. That's somebody who knows how to do primer design.
So this is speaking from someone who knows absolutely nothing about primer design. Does that mean, theoretically, if you had an enigmatic organism, you could make a bunch of primers, and if it didn't react with any of them, then it's not any of those things?
You definitely, for the first part of that question, yes, you could do that. So for instance, like when there are people working on things like you know, the thylacine, which has no kind of close living relatives, they could design, you know, a marsupial set of primers that would work with all marsupials. They were just that conserved. But the second part, so I would be very, if it didn't work, you know, that I have a lot of times where things didn't work in PCR, and I never thought, oh, well, it's definitely not what I'm trying to amplify.
Oh, I see. Okay.
It's, I mean, there's so many kind of variables that you'd have to kind of try a bunch of different things before you could be certain.
Okay. And, so it couldn't be used diagnostically like that then?
No, not unless you have, I mean, it can be if you have a very well explored system. So, you know, I'm trying to think of something that would be, you know, if we're looking at a kind of a forensic example. So if you had, let's say, someone's claimed they've got tiger bone wine or something, you could design a set of primers that only amplify tiger, and then you could use that on your kind of confiscated tiger wine. And if it doesn't amplify, and it's a really kind of well-designed and well-used system of primers, and it doesn't amplify, then you can say that, well, that's not tiger then. Right. Whatever's in that wine is not tiger. And there's other ways you could do that as well. But if it's, if you're like trying to find, you know, DNA from, I don't know, Toxodon or something, one of those weird South American notoungulates, and you tried some primers and they didn't work, then it'd just be back to the drawing board and try something different until you get an amplification.
Because the only reason I ask is, A, I'm an idiot, but B, also, because I was wondering, like, if you had let's say, for instance, you came across a cave deposit and it was full of all sorts of bones and you couldn't work out what the bones were, I suppose you could DNA fingerprint them. Would the primers be the primary way of doing that, or would you actually just try and identify the DNA?
Absolutely. I mean, people do this just now. So my friend Mike that I mentioned earlier has done a lot of cave work in the States and Australia. And one thing they do is, I mean, the whole field has kind of moved away from PCR recently to the whole kind of genome sequencing stuff, which is a slightly different chemistry. And there, what you can do is, once you've extracted your DNA, you can basically add little tags to every fragment of DNA that's in your extract, and then amplify everything and sequence everything. And that will give you a fairly good overview of what's in your kind of cave sediment. And so people have used this to look at kind of horizons in cave deposits and say, we've got sequences from all these animals, and later on we've got all these sequences from other animals, and we find these guys here, but not later on. And it's great, and it does seem to work pretty robustly, but you just have to be careful about how much you kind of rely on no DNA being there, meaning that the animal wasn't there, or that DNA being there means that the animal was there a lot, or, you know, was living there rather than being like using it as a latrine or something. I mean, there's a lot of variables here, but absolutely that is something that people can do and are doing.
Wow, I sounded clever and I didn't even mean to.
on that thought, we're normally taught that, you know, the fossil record is really fragmentary and it's really hard to get any like proper estimates from it, and that DNA is the one true way to go. But DNA brings its own biases as well, which is kind of crazy to think that nothing is perfect. We might never get there to like the correct answer. But hearing that has kind of really brought that home.
And it's something you hear a lot, I think, that, you know, people get this kind of, you know, they're biased by CSI, that, you know, DNA is the only true answer. And you know, it has its own biases too. And these things have to work kind of synergistically. You have to work together. I mean, we wouldn't have the knowledge about ancient DNA we have if we didn't have paleontologists to have identified the bones that we were trying to look at, first of all, excavating the deposits that we wanted to look at and all this kind of stuff. I mean, it's not, you know, we're the best and everyone else is not as good. It's like these things have to be taken together.
An extra link in the chain.
Hmm.
The links in the chain.
Oh,
I'll see myself out.
Excellent.
Oh dear, I'm actually slightly disgusted. So there's lots of questions. We've got one question. We've got one from paleontology saying, "Listening here, DNA stuff sounds super easy." can you summarize why we can't master DNA and modify/create new life?
Well, okay, that's a big question. It is super easy once you know evolution's done all the hard work. in terms of, you know, genetic modification, I mean, this is outside of my area of sort of knowledge, but starting from scratch is a very different prospect from just sort of tweaking a few things here and there. So that's where they're starting at the minute. I mean, to kind of tie it into ancient DNA and kind of Ice Age animals, there's George Church's lab in California. They're looking at tweaking elephant cells, making them a little bit mammoth, which is quite interesting. So it used to be that you couldn't really make modifications of mammalian cells in vivo. Like living cells, you couldn't change them without killing them, because obviously you're kind of messing up their DNA and they need that to survive. But over the past kind of few years, a big new technique has come called CRISPR-Cas9, which is one of those things that I think there's been a lot of discussion about who gets credit for inventing it, and that's kind of turned quite nasty. But I mean, it's kind of the next big thing in terms of genetic modification. And so the lab that George Church is running has taken elephant cells and modified them a wee bit to make some of the elephant genes mammoth genes, which is quite cool. But that's a long, long way from bringing back mammoths, that's for sure.
Yeah.
I was like, nip that in the bud there.
Yeah. And done.
I think this is quite a common question, and we've talked about it, I think, in episodes past about bringing back animals. And in fact, someone has already asked, you know, if you could bring back one species, what would it be? But I think what I'd be more interested in hearing from you is, should we bring back animals if we could?
I think that's the better question, Thomas. Yeah, I think that's
smart again without even meaning to.
I mean, yeah, it's to bring it back to Jurassic Park again, I mean, it's so...
Sorry, let me get the klaxon.
Yeah. You know, we think so much about whether we can, and we don't think about so much about whether we should. And definitely, I'm kind of on the side that, you know, even if it was possible, there's some very big ethical questions around whether it'd be right. Certainly for things like the mammoth and the saber tooth and the kind of Ice Age animals. I mean, I think it's more straightforward with some of the more recent extinctions like dodo or passenger pigeon, great auk, all these things which are clearly, you know, we know the term, sometimes even the names of the people that killed the last ones, and why, you know, human effects had brought their population to such low numbers. So there's definitely, there's nuances there that need to be properly addressed before we can start thinking about which one to bring back.
Now I really want to know what your favorite one to bring back would be.
Yeah, I should have an answer for that, but I don't know if I do. I think maybe no, I couldn't give just one. Oh,
we have all night.
I think maybe great ox, because I think they're just they're kind of really, they had a really tough time at the hands of people, and I mean they're beautiful. Inoffensive, you know, they're missed, and yeah, they're, yeah. I think I have a very big soft spot for them. But then also, you know, Stellar Sea Cow, the Dodo.
Yes, Nasaba in the chat has already asked about the Dodo, and we... Yeah,
I think Nasaba might be from Mauritius.
Well, that's what I was just about to say, as a Mauritian, she probably has quite strong feelings about the Dodo. Yes. And...
I'm so glad that you mentioned the great auk, because it was like the flagship species of my university's zoology department. And we kind of grew up through our undergrad degree learning so much about this auk. And like it's such a cute little species. It's like a little puffin, but big puffin.
Big puffin.
Yeah. And yeah, and it's so cool. I never, like, I mentioned it to people. I did a presentation on it once and nobody knew what this animal was. And I was like, oh, you are missing out. Mm-hmm. But yeah, I'm so glad you mentioned it. It's brought back memories for me as well.
I do love them. They're just iconic. I think they're kind of almost forgotten icon of the North Atlantic. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. I think from a very cynical perspective, because I am a very cynical human being, I also think that it's quite a dangerous and slippery slope, because let's say, for instance, like at the moment, some charismatic animals like the albatross are under a lot of threat. And so I think there's this idea that if we could just bring them back, then what's the point of even trying to bother saving them at the moment? And I have seen people advocate that, which is almost like it's the most terrible thing I can possibly think of.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. I mean, that is I think one of the biggest dangers is the complacency that could set in if we were able to bring back, you know, these kind of zoo freaks that have some of the same genetics as extinct species. I mean, it's not the same. Mm. You're not bringing back the microbiome. You're not bringing back the culture of these animals, which do have culture. You're not bringing back, you know, it's going to be a kind of circus freak, essentially, which might be interesting to look at in a zoo, but it's not going to be the same as having the living species in its own ecosystem doing its own ecological things.
Yeah, yeah. And I think that's super interesting as well, right? Because even if we, let's say hypothetically, we could bring back mammoths, we're not bringing them back into the world they knew. Mm-hmm. And that's, to me, is a big fundamental problem. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
It's a world that's very different. I mean, so this links to a passage from your book, actually, that I thought was really interesting. And just really, I think there's a lot in your book that talks about how we as humans just forget about the past. Mm-hmm. And like what we experience during our lifetime is marked as the norm, and anything before or afterwards is kind of ignored. And you have this section, and you're talking about the Portuguese sailors who devastated Mauritius cared little for the plight of the dodo, and it's only with hindsight that the obvious qualities of these lost species come into focus, and it's all too human to suddenly want what we can't have. Mm-hmm. I thought I was so powerful and so true that we are currently in a world where there are innumerable number of species that are, you know, on the verge, and with little human interest for a vast swathe of them. So my question, I was just going to ask, what is the species that you think we should reevaluate now? Like, what's the species that you think that we should be like, this is crucial. This is really one that we need to like look after.
Well, I mean, I think definitely, and it ties into what you're saying as well, is that it's the ones that we don't pay much attention to that are going to be the crucial ones. So we've got to look at, you know, the insects. We've got to look at the kind of less charismatic, the microfauna are the ones that are going to have the biggest effects, I think, down the line. So definitely what has worried me personally the most is the kind of massive decreases in insect biomass that we've seen just in the kind of past 30 years. All these surveys they've done where they're finding like, you know, 75% fewer flying insects just in kind of parts of Western Europe. And that's a really kind of worrying statistic because, you know, they're the base of the whole kind of ecosystem. And if those things start to go, then we're in real serious problems.
And they're also, insects especially, so difficult to know about their past from the fossil record.
They're
not exactly a common thing to preserve in a lot of cases.
Absolutely.
So understanding, you know, how they react to mass extinctions is something that we actually don't have an enormous amount of idea of.
Mm.
And so we don't know if what we're doing kind of now is different or if it's the same or...
We kind of don't have even a baseline to kind of work out how they rebound, if they rebound, and, you know, how permanent is the damage that we're doing. That's scary.
It's a little bit scary. Sorry, I brought the guy from the new town massively there. Like, oh, no. Oh, I mean, it just happens. If you're talking about extinction, it's going to come up.
Because in your book you talk a lot about this, it must be kind of depressing just to write about all of these amazing organisms that just wiped off the face of the earth by human beings. And every conversation stems down to this. It's just awful.
Yeah, it's not the biggest you know party winner.
But in your book you talk a lot about reintroductions, right? You talk about some of those, like the good stories that are actually happening for the animals that we kind of just very recently lost from some areas.
I kind of had to. I mean, that was the only way to kind of not end up, you know, just slitting my wrists, I think, towards the end, is that you have to kind of look for the kind of good news stories, which are there, but you do have to look kind of quite hard for them. And so, yeah, I kind of found myself, I mean, thankfully it was towards the end of I kind of mostly wrote it in the order that it's in the book. And so writing the last chapters about, you know, the beaver and some of the stories of reintroductions of the tortoises and things like that was actually a lifesaver, really, as the writer.
There's lots of interesting things about that. So B-Wits in the chat has literally said the same thing, saying, as opposed to bringing back extinct organisms, what do you think about proposed rewilding efforts using modern ecological analogues? Which I think is a very good question, because there's a whole thing about in Yellowstone, isn't there, about how introducing apex predators like fundamentally changed not only like the ecosystem, but the actual geography, right? Yeah.
Absolutely. And I was thinking about that this week as well, because in the news that I can't remember if it was around Yellowstone or somewhere where they reintroduced wolves and the knock-on effect that's had on deer population.
Yes.
It's actually had a massive decrease in the number of motorist deaths, because there's fewer deer running into the road, getting hit by cars and taking out the whole family that are driving. So, you know, it's almost, ecology is almost too complex to ever probably kind of model that there's all these kind of, you know, unimaginable consequences. Who would have thought that, you know, reintroducing wolves to Yellowstone or whatever it is that they're talking about actually has the effect of reducing you know, motorist deaths on highways, that kind of thing. You know, it's really incredible. And so the question of bringing back ecological analogs, I think is great. I mean, this is a slightly different question from bringing back species that have actually gone extinct. So with ecological analogs, you're talking about things that may never have lived where you're proposing bringing them back, but something similar did once. And so it's a very kind of, I guess, there's an overlap between what one person's ecological analog is another person's invasive species. And so you've got to be, I think, very careful about bringing in ecological analogs so that they don't have all these unintended negative consequences, which we know can happen with accidental introductions of things like, you know, like rabbits to Australia or you know, beavers to Patagonia, that kind of thing. So I think definitely the case for kind of straight reintroduction, things like bringing back the lynx to the UK or bringing back wolves to different parts of the states where they're extinct, you know, that's 100% a fantastic idea that should be done wherever, you know, at all possible. But we just have to be a bit more careful with the kind of idea of bringing back, you know, giant tortoises from Aldabra, putting them in Mauritius, where the Mauritius one is completely extinct. And these are just the closest kind of living analog that we could have, but they're not the same, and they could have unintended effects on what is already a, you know, kind of quite a precarious situation.
We're all nodding. People who are listening, who are listening on the podcast who can't see us, we're all like silently nodding along,
like completely enthralled.
Yeah. I was absolutely stunned when I heard the story about how we're reintroducing wolves. Like changed the rivers and how the rivers ran and reduced flooding and landslips, because by eating the deer don't eat so many of the young saplings, which means that the hillsides are stabilized, which means the rivers can't like cut through them as quickly. That just absolutely blew my mind. And yeah, it's just,
I think, you know, speaking with the kind of paleo hat on, it just sort of, you kind of boggles the mind as well. You know, we'll kind of never get an idea of what all these kind of extinct species, the true effects they had on their habitat, on their landscapes. You know, the idea that maybe, you know, glyptodonts in South America helped to kind of wear down mountains because they dug tunnels and all that kind of stuff, or, you know, whatever, all these kind of living effects that just we can't get from the paleo record, which is quite sad.
Yeah, it even makes you think about, to think of like ecological connections like that being so complex and so unpredictable. Like we have no idea what dinosaur ecosystems were like. Like even just the most famous example from paleontology, that the way they interacted with their ecosystems is so intricate that we'll never we'll never quite understand it. And it's fascinating to think of it like that.
The story, right, I could be talking absolute baloney here, but I believe I've read a paper which suggests that avocados exist as they are with the pip, because the pip is so big, there's no way that pip could be spread by birds or anything like that. So the reason avocados have such big pips is because they were spread by megafauna, right? Like the like big elephants and glyptodons and things. And it was only because human beings liked avocados that they've basically not gone extinct with the megafauna. Is that correct?
That's definitely, there's a reasonable amount of evidence for that. So particularly in North and South America, there's a lot of plant species, tree species, which have enormous kind of fleshy, fruity seeds, which nothing that's around the kind of mesofauna and, like, I guess the biggest thing's the bison there or tapirs in South America, they just can't process them. So definitely, this is something that was put forward by Paul Martin, the guy that kind of, I don't want to say invented, but described his ideas about overkill and human overkill of megafauna. He put this forward. In fact, somewhere, let's see if I can, I don't think it's in this bookshelf.
For everyone who's listening, Ross is looking for a book in the background.
Yeah, it's not up here, but somewhere else. He wrote a book called The Ghosts of Evolution, which is all about them. So there's you know, things like the Osage orange, which is this big kind of grapefruit-sized thing, which nothing eats. And every kind of year in the States, this, like, all the trees just drop their fruit and it just lies there and rots because nothing can eat it. And so I think, yeah, there's maybe, you know, mastodons and gomphotheres and all these other kind of megafauna were the missing disperser of a lot of these plants. And it's just, yeah, it's just human intervention now that has kind of kept them going.
That's wild. Mm. There you go. No, I bet no one who's listening to Paleo Party thought we'd be talking about avocados.
Thinking of your bookshelf behind you, I think we might go off on a little of a tangent here, but as an author yourself, what is your favorite pop science book that involves paleontology?
Oh, that's a good question. Let me see, I might be able to actually find it if it's up here.
Also, 10 out of 10 for bookshelf background.
I know the answer. So my favorite pop sci
Oh, excellent
this
choice.
one. So The Big Cats and Their Fossil Relatives by Alan Turner and Maurice Anton. I don't know if you can, you know, the people at home will be able to see, but look how well thumbed that is.
Oh, yeah, that's,
that's pretty gross.
There's
really
quite a clear break
wow.
there in the book where it's been held open.
Maxio's art is just excellent, beautiful, chef's kiss. Yes.
And if I could just boast slightly, but...
Ooh, a signed copy with warm regards.
Yeah.
Just regards.
So yeah, that's I mean, there's a few other books in the bookshelf that have kind of tried to cut a similar furrow, but I think it's still the best, not just for someone that was starting out in kind of big cat paleo, it was just absolutely essential, and it kind of brought me up to speed in a very kind of gentle way with what I should know about the extinct cats and their fossil relatives. But it's also kind of very readable from a kind of lay perspective as well. And the illustrations are, you know, second to none. I mean, there's very few people that can match Mauricio Anton for reconstructions.
Yeah. I bet that if anybody's listening and has no idea about paleo art, if you've seen a reconstruction of a paleo landscape with a big cat in it, it's probably Mauricio's.
Yeah.
they're like iconic like drawings, aren't they? This leads on very nicely to a question that we got actually very early in the chat from Lewis Jones, which was, did you enjoy your experience of writing your book? And I suppose the second part of that is, how do you write? Do you just sit down and smash it out, or do you sit there sweating as it like drips out of you one word at a time?
Yeah, well, those are great questions. Both. I mean... It really depends. I mean, some days, not very many days, but some days it kind of just poured out of you a little bit. Other days it was like, you know, it was hard going. But I think what helped for me was having deadlines. So I started writing it in, I think, about October 2017. And I knew I had to hand it in October 2018. But then I also moved house and country in August 2018, and so that kind of focused the mind a little bit. So the kind of last 2 months, it was just, you know, absolute frenzy of trying to get stuff done. I don't know if that comes across in the book, but
it doesn't
at all.
It definitely doesn't read like any of my work that's been done last minute, where like very important like whole paragraphs become one sentence.
I think there's some. I don't feel like I'm a natural writer, whatever. It was something that like just had to. It was kind of I had to force myself to do it sometimes, and a lot of it was kind of quite a slog. Even though, you know, I really love talking about Megaphone, I really love kind of learning about them and sort of sharing that. But I think whenever you write anything that you know other people are going to read, you have kind of a lot of self-criticism and sort of you kind of take things, you know, you take them apart and put them back together a lot, and that makes it a slow process. You know, that's how I did it.
Completely reject your idea that you're a bad writer. I read your entire book through your voice, and it was such a conversational piece. I felt like I was being told off at certain points and like spurred on to like motivate into action at other points. It was phenomenal. And I think of myself as a book connoisseur, and I really don't get into science books that are vaguely related to my work, because I'll just get angry because somebody will say something they shouldn't have said or a way they shouldn't have said. But I ate that up. I loved it so much. And oh, Chris, thanks. I think you were about to say the same.
Yeah, I mean, I picked it up last week, and I'm about, I would say, just over halfway through. So I'm up to chatting about bears, which is very interesting. Did not know cave bears were herbivores. Yeah. That was fascinating. Had no idea that, I mean, guess you got pandas, but yeah, blew my mind. It's just, I would thoroughly advise anyone listening to pick it up. It is a really, really engaging read. And
thanks, guys.
Just manages to, just describe a section of prehistory that I had no idea about in exceptional detail and in such a engaging conversational way. That's just, really exciting to pick up on.
Hashtag not sponsored.
Yeah, we didn't even bring Ross here to talk about the book.
Like, are you going to write? Can you write us the check at the end?
Yeah, that's it. It's in the post. In the book.
Thanks very much. I appreciate it.
I did have a question to ask about the book. There's a thing that comes up multiple times, and it's something that I, again, vaguely aware of, but this really like kind of brought it to the forefront of my mind, of this, how much paleontological data you can get from cave paintings. Mm. Oh my God. Like, obviously just, it makes logical sense, but I just never thought of it before, that you get this window into seeing the, like the colors, the shapes, all of these parts, and even like the hunting or the ecology of some of these animals through art from us from thousands of years ago. That was amazing to me, and I just wanted to know, like, is there anything particular that you found that like really fascinated you in that regard? Is there anything that, like, any particular painting or depiction that you were really like, oh my God, this is like,
yeah,
really?
Well, I think Chris, I think you, the way you're sort of phrasing that question, I think you probably know my answer. But, I would say definitely the Lowenmensch. So I think I spent a lot of time in the book writing about it. And it's for anyone that hasn't seen it, it's carved from mammoth ivory. It's about, I think, 35,000 years old from a cave site in Germany. And it's a kind of human body, but with a cave lion's head. And it was found in like 700 different bits and kind of carefully pieced back together. And it's like nothing else really for or almost since in the kind of archaeological record. It's you know, the human imagination carved into a bit of ivory, and our kind of first evidence for the kind of flights of fancy that we really associate with art and humanity today, this idea of, you know, making stuff up, which we haven't really got much evidence for that happening before the Lowenmensch. All the art we have is either linear or, you know, kind of geometric, or is off living creatures that people could have seen and drawn from life. So the idea of, you know, a human but with a lion's head, I mean, there's so much symbolism there. I mean, this is something when I talk about, you know, this is like an idea that's still around today. Thomas, you know, from D&D, there's, you know, like lion-headed creatures are part of, you know, a lot of fantasy settings, you know, in kind of StarCraft and other kind of video games in, you know, ancient Egypt. This is something that, you know, is there in human imagination continuously up until the present day, the idea of humans with kind of lion attributes or other big cat attributes. And so that's definitely, I think, it's so mysterious as well. What did it mean to these people? Mm. We can put our own kind of interpretations onto, you know, the idea that maybe it was about harnessing the power of the cave lion. It was about, you know, ideas about, you know, afterlife and rebirth and all these kind of things. We could say, you know, pretty much anything you want about it, and you could still kind of stroke your chin and say yes, probably. But yeah, I think that's my favorite from all of the kind of history of Pleistocene art, and I'm sure it's going to tell us more in the future. And, you know, maybe they'll find other examples which will kind of show us things in a different light. Who knows?
I love thinking about the intersection between paleontology and art, and we've already talked about Marcio's wonderful work, but this in the same way, that go hand in hand, and we're always kind of told, oh no, science is not creative in that sense, but no, here we are.
It's so wrong. I mean, some of the most creative people I know are kind of really great scientists as well. Yeah. And, you know, a lot of the creative people I know are actually think in very sciencey ways as well. And, you know, the best scientists I know are creative, and that's how they get to be the best scientists. They have a lot, they use their imagination a lot, and that's what takes them in new scientific directions. So to kind of bring things down again, it kind of makes me feel really sad when we're sort of seeing in the news about how, you know, funding is being cut for all these kind of, for the humanities, for the arts, for everything else. And, you know, kind of, as someone who's come from a, you know, biochemistry and zoology, that's my background. And I'm the kind of person that maybe if things had gone wrong for me, I'd be sort of cheering those on, say, yes, we need more STEM, we need more IT, all this kind of stuff. But, you know, humanities are so essential that it just really, really angers me that people don't see it that way.
Yeah, for sure. I totally echo that.
I tell you what we need is, we need more cave lion-headed people to run funding agencies. That's what we need.
Yeah, they would sort it out.
Yeah,
for sure.
Exactly. There'd be no messing around. So there have been a few more questions in the chat. We're getting towards the end of the stream, and I think this question is actually a really, actually quite an interesting question. But it says, we're increasingly seeing specimens being uncovered with workable ancient DNA in areas like Siberia and North America, I presume permafrost. Things like direwolves, cave lions, mammoths, recently to name a few. But is there a specific species that you would consider a holy grail that you would love to get some ancient DNA material from to work on above all else?
That's a good question. Let me think for a second. There's definitely species that I would love to see come out as a permafrost mummy. I mean, that's something that I've spent a bit of time thinking about. And with, you know, the increased melting of the permafrost, we're seeing a lot more mummies than we have at any time in the past. And so it's been really exciting. There's been like 4 cave lion cubs uncovered just in the past, you know, 5 years, and there'd been 0 in all of recorded history before then. We're seeing kind of woolly rhinos and lots more mammoths coming up. But I think what I would most like to see is a preserved saber-tooth cat from the permafrost of Siberia. So we know that a particular species of saber-tooth, Homo didens, was around the right place at the right time that could potentially have been turned into a mummy. If it happened for cave lions, it could happen for saber-tooths. And I think I would lose my shit completely if we dug up one of those guys, because that'd be so incredible just to see, you know, we just don't know very much about them. I mean, what their fur was like. I mean, we think about cats today, whether they've got spots or stripes or plain coloring informs so much about what we know about them, about how they hunt, about their character. And if we could get that from the saber-tooth cat, that would tell us an awful lot. Mm. Or, you know, even stuff like the kind of soft tissues of the face, are the canines fully exposed? Are they kind of covered in little kind of flesh pockets? Around the gums.
I don't know why I didn't like that, but that didn't sound nice at all.
Yeah, maybe I should rephrase that. Like
fleshy pockets.
Yeah, maybe there's kind of. Yeah, you put me off now, Tom.
Sorry, I'm sorry, sorry. I'm so sorry. So sorry. Apologize profusely.
The way through that, I was only just thinking of like, oh, a silver lining of climate change, permafrost melting. How lovely.
Yeah, but the bad side of it is as well that it's like loads of carcasses that have like horrific like diseases are coming out as well. Like anthrax is massively on the rise, and oh yeah, yeah. Quick question.
That's the methane as well. Yeah, but...
yeah. Sorry, go on.
We're just adding to the climate change.
Oh, sorry.
I kept mentioning methane.
I was just, oh gosh, yeah, methane. Right, we're back on the down low again. But yeah. I was going to ask about Smilodon and saber cats. Mm-hmm. I know there's quite a lot of debate, isn't there, about whether they basically use their teeth to like, basically, if they like ran up behind something and stabbed it with the teeth, would the teeth rip off? That's what I'm asking.
Well, I mean, I don't think there's been anything really written about as much in sort of quaternary paleontology as how saber-tooths use their saber teeth. Mm. And so, I mean, one thing we know for definite is that they weren't stabbers. They didn't just like, you know, like that.
sorry. For people who are listening, that was a very sort of limp-wristed that just happened.
I was just trying, you know, it wasn't just using their kind of teeth on their own. It's a whole kind of suite of adaptations that they have. So Smilodon is the kind of classic example. I mean, it's built essentially like a bear. It has incredibly muscled forearms, and it's these that it's using to kind of immobilize the prey before it gives the bite. So it's kind of a wrestler, essentially. It kind of wrestles things to the ground, and it uses its teeth in a kind of quite complex way. And there is a lot of risk to them. I mean, as you rightly point out, Thomas, they're quite thin and they're quite easily breakable. And so we know that they must have been very precise in their placement. And one of the things that people have looked at is, you know, what was the position of the gum in saber-tooth cats? Did it go all the way down to where the enamel starts, or did it sort of stop just above the jawline? I mean, it's one of those things that you think, my God, people's tax money is going towards this. But, you know, it's really
important.
Interesting.
We must know.
Yeah, it's really interesting because, I mean, people have looked at it and they think, you know, saber-tooths would have looked in life incredibly gummy. I don't have one up here, but...
What, a saber cat? How did you have one at all?
I mean, a replica.
Okay. You haven't just been bringing them back in your garden shed without telling anyone.
Yeah, that's why I had to leave academia.
Oh, but it's all making sense there.
I knew there was a reason why it said disgraced.
But yeah, so if you look at the kind of replica of a saber tooth from Smilodon, then there's the very clear that the most of the tooth is actually kind of root, and the enamel is only about a third to halfway up. And so all the rest of it would have been gum. They would have been incredibly gummy. And the gum has a really distinct profile as well, which probably helped them when they were kind of putting their teeth into the prey to know exactly where they were placing it. So back to your question, yes, they occasionally got broken. We have fossils where we know the animal survived after breaking. It's got wear on the broken part of the tooth. But for the most part, they were very kind of precise about the replacement of the killing bite. And it involved not just the front teeth, but also the lower jaw and really incredibly strong neck muscles as well that they had. The kind of best way that I have of understanding it is they kind of use the lower jaw as basically like as a buttress, and then the kind of canines come in, like hinge over the lower jaw, which isn't very strong. And then it's the neck muscles themselves that are the kind of force for pulling backwards and ripping out the flesh. So, I mean, there's been some incredible experiments, like some experimental paleontology experiments done with a kind of backhoe that had a saber-tooth skull attachment. And they used that to kind of mangle some bison carcasses and horse carcasses to try and experimentally have a look at how it worked. I mean, how they actually used their teeth. So yeah, there's a whole kind of subfield discipline there looking at just how these teeth were used.
I used to think of saber teeth as like quite an elegant killer. They're bloody gruesome.
Yeah, they would be messy for sure.
Yeah, I mean, that, like, we've often talked in the past about how, like, going back in time and if there's like one particular thing we would like to have seen in the past. But that is definitely if you watch like sort of Planet Earth and you watch a cheetah hunt or a lion, like a pack of lions hunt, that is spectacular. A saber cat would have been something just on another level. Mm-hmm. So, I bet there's so much blood. I bet it was awesome.
Yeah. You have to bring your waterproofs.
This is the note we're going to end on, is it?
Yeah. Yeah. So if you need to, basically, if you're going back in time to watch a saber cat, take wellies, is what we're saying. I actually think that's a really good place to end. And yeah, I think we've hit our hourly slot anyway. So I guess it's just left basically to say thank you very much, Ross. We really appreciated hanging out with you this evening.
It's been so much fun.
And thank you to everyone who tuned in and asked questions tonight. Remember, we'll be back next week. Our website is up to date, so you can get all the information about who our next guest is on our website. Also, if you subscribe on Twitch, it will let you know when we're streaming next time. And you can also find our podcasts on Spotify, YouTube, Anchor, or pretty much anywhere where you can download podcasts. And like Chris said earlier, you can follow us on Paleo Party for all the information. So basically, thanks again, Ross. It's been lovely to talk to you. And I hope to say that we'll see you all next week for another Paleo Party. So goodbye, everyone.
Bye.
Bye, everyone.
And and with that, I'm going to log us off.